This is all theater. This is all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill and across the country. I'm Jason Dick.
Lost, perhaps, in this year's highly competitive presidential nominating contest, sarcasm detected, is the coming-at-you primaries for House and Senate that kicked off with a bang on Super Tuesday. We got some clarity about fall matchups in some high-profile races on that most special of Tuesdays, and some of that clarity came from folks who are not even facing the voters. With us to discuss is Jacob Rabashkin, Deputy Editor of Insight Elections. Jacob, welcome back to Political Theater.
Thanks for having me.
So, yes, I couldn't help but notice that there is somewhat of a preoccupation with a lot of media outlets about the presidential contest. That's great. That means Roll Call and Inside Elections can have the congressional primaries to themselves because they're way more interesting to me, at least. We know who the two nominees are going to be, barring an act of God. So it'll be Donald Trump and Joe Biden. There we go. There's the headline that they spent all the time doing on the board, the magic boards and so forth. I think Haley still is in double digits for her delegate count, and that's as close as anything gets. But there was a lot. I mean, our previous podcast that I did with our friends Mel McIntyre and Daniela Altomare, we kind of ran down through a lot of the House races taking place on Super Tuesday. A quarter of the House is up. Not all those were competitive elections, but certainly one, the California Senate race, in addition to the competitive House seats, particularly in Southern California, Orange County, and so forth, the California Senate race attracted a lot of attention. We thought the sort of conventional wisdom for a while would be Adam Schiff, most likely, versus either Katie Porter or Barbara Lee, all Democrats, going for this sort of once-in-a-generation shot at the late Dianne Feinstein seat. And then Steve Garvey raised his glove, first baseman's mitt hand to enter the race as a Republican, and the dynamic shifted, and he will be he advanced to again, California has this primary where it's a nonpartisan primary, so the top two finishers, regardless of party, advance to the November election. It'll be Adam Schiff and Steve Garvey, a Democrat and Republican. How did Steve Garvey make the transition from, he's still around? Didn't know that. He's not a Hall of Famer. Maybe, there's debate about whether he should be or not. But he didn't really have a lot of money. And aside from being famous for baseball and also having an interesting family situation, there wasn't a whole lot about Garvey. How did he end up in the number two slot?
Well, he got a lot of help from his buddy, Adam Schiff, who took it upon himself to basically run two Senate campaigns, right? Usually Senate candidates only run one campaign. They run a campaign for themselves. They run positive about themselves. They run negative about their opponents, and they call it a day. Especially in a state like California, which is so exorbitantly expensive, it's almost unthinkable that a candidate would have enough money to run more than one Senate campaign. But ultimately, what we saw is that Schiff was able to do both. He was able to run a campaign appealing to Democrats in the state, where he was, facing off between Katie Porter and Barbara Lee. But he was also to put the millions, tens of millions of dollars that he raised. He raised upwards of $30 million. He was able to put about half of that toward effectively running a shadow campaign for Steve Garvey. Steve Garvey did not air any TV ads himself. He didn't do much campaigning. He showed up to the debates, and that was about it. It was Adam Schiff and Schiff's money and Schiff's allies who got Garvey's name out there, let California voters know he was running for Senate, that he was conservative, that he liked Trump, all the things he needed to do to consolidate the Republican vote.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we joke about all the kind of tin hat foil wearing conservative theories about psyops and so forth, and Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce and Joe Biden and all this kind of stuff. But this actually was pretty close to a psyop because Adam Schiff was running ads criticizing Steve Garvey for, as you said, being conservative and being close to Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. But as you said, this really leached support away from perhaps some Republicans who might have considered voting for Katie Porter or even Barbara Lee or any other, you know, person on the ballot to Garvey, saying like, well, if he's Trump's guy, I'm going to vote for him. Of course, the dynamic of this is that this is going to be a likely Democratic seat regardless. But the difference is Schiff gets to run against a Republican. He will have the advantage, to say the least, in a state that's dominated at the federal level by Democrats. And also Chuck Schumer gets to breathe a sigh of relief that he doesn't see $50 to $75 to $100 million spent on a seat that features two Democrats running against one another.
Yeah, I think a couple things had to happen for this strategy to be successful. And it was not really clear up until relatively recently, I would argue, that it was going to be successful. I think that it required continued blockbuster fundraising from Schiff. And to your point, I think that obviously it's a bit of an underhanded tactic, but Schiff ran those ads himself. I think there was an expectation running into this primary that he would leave that kind of dirty work to the super PACs that were supporting his bid. And there were some of those who did that kind of pro-Garvey messaging, but he was putting his name on a lot of those advertisements. It was not at all hidden what he was doing here. But look, I think that what had to happen was you had to have a Republican who people knew, because people know Steve Garvey from the baseball days, but not one that was actually going to be a threat. And any Republican can be a threat in California these days. And ultimately,
Federal level, at least. Orange County is a different thing.
But, I think that there were other Republicans on the ballot, right? There were kind of perennial candidates and a few guys who had run statewide before. And absent a Steve Garvey type figure, I think that we could have seen significantly more scattering among those Republican candidates. But because Garvey had the residual name ID and enough of a profile, he was a well-designed vessel for this strategy that Schiff ran. If it had been James Bradley or Eric Early or one of the other Republicans who was running on the ballot and no Steve Garvey, I'm not sure that it would have worked, right? I mean, look, if you were on the ballot in California, I maybe I'm wrong, but I got to think if Adam Schiff spent $15 million on you running in California, I'm not sure that you could have gotten to 35% like Steve Garvey. I just don't know. I think that it had to be someone with a little bit of a leg to stand on right out the gate.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there is this has a slight, perhaps very minuscule chance of backfiring. Not that Garvey has as much of a chance in a state, again, where Democrats outnumber, Republicans by boatloads. But if more people turn out in some of those House races, I mean, this was some of the criticism that Porter's allies pointed out in their releases, sort of commenting on this, saying, that they were not happy with what Schiff had been able to pull off. But that this has the potential to bring out Republican turnout in some of these districts in the House that the Democrats want to flip. I mean, that is perhaps a slight chance. Who knows? But again, this is a long way to November.
Find me one person who is going to turn out to vote for Steve Garvey who would not have turned out to vote for Donald Trump in the fall, no matter what. Steve Garvey is not driving turnout. He's not even running a campaign. And you can best believe Adam Schiff is not going to continue to run his campaign for him now that we're in the general election. Trump drives turnout. Steve Garvey does not drive turnout. And so whether it was a Porter-Schiff race or a Schiff-Garvey race, people are going to show up to vote in the presidential, and then they're going to look down and say, oh, there's a Senate race going on too. I might as well cast a ballot there.
Right. All right. Let's move east to the great state, the Grand Canyon state, my state, my home state of Arizona, where until yesterday we were looking at the possibility of a three-way race among, since there are three of them, not just two, among Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat turned independent incumbent, who's elected first in 2018, and likely Carrie Lake, the Republican who did lose the gubernatorial election in 2022, even though she insists that she did not lose still, and Congressman Ruben Gallego, a Democrat from the Phoenix area, who's in the House now. Sinema facing a sort of daunting task of collecting several thousand signatures of just independents, couldn't collect, you know, signatures for Democrats and Republicans, and also a little bit of a fundraising, you know, dearth, decided that she was not going to run. She said that her brand of politics was not being rewarded, that she had preached this pragmatism. And so she dropped out and effectively made it a two-person race. Now it's between Carrie Lake and Ruben Gallego, most likely and most grammatically. So what do you make of this race? I mean, it's a toss-up on inside elections, a real pure toss-up. Arizona, did not elect Democrats to the Senate from Dennis DeConcini who left office in the 90s until Sinema in 2018. And then she kind of promptly left the Democratic Party. But, you know, Mark Kelly has won now since then. But it's still this very purple state. What's your take on the dynamics of the race and how it's changed?
Yeah, look, I think that in some ways, not much has changed at all. We expected this to be a close and competitive race. And for a little while now, it's been pretty clear that Sinema was not doing the things she needed to do in order to stand for re-election. I mean, even just kind of the blocking and tackling of getting on the ballot, right? It's a high threshold for an independent candidate to make the ballot in Arizona. She was not spending the money or time or energy to meet that threshold. So ultimately, I would have been far more surprised if she had run for re-election versus bowing out as she did. Look, I think that ultimately she was probably drawing close to equal proportion from both Carrie Lake and Ruben Gallego. I think maybe there's an argument to be made that she was actually drawing a little bit more from Lake than Gallego, even though, you know, she's a former Democrat herself. And so that might give Lake a little bit of an immediate boost in polling, perhaps, as those votes kind of reallocate themselves back to the major party candidates. But the reality is, right, I mean, Republicans have a problem in this state. They have had a problem in this state pretty much since Sinema won that first race in 2018. That was a real harbinger of a shift in the state's politics. Since then, if you look at everything post-2018, Biden, you know, Sinema wins that race. Biden wins in 2020 alongside Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly wins in 2022 again. Katie Hobbs beats Carrie Lake. The other kind of big statewide offices, Secretary of State, Attorney General, both of those are won by Democratic candidates. Republicans now only hold, I believe, the mine inspector and the state treasurer.
Those are important roles, Jacob, in Arizona, particularly mining.
I mean, sure, I'll take your word for it, but what a come down from right. where they were a right. decade ago. And Carrie Lake, of all people, is probably not the person to turn the tide. I mean, I think that there's a reason so many Republicans were gravitating towards Sinema when she was an option, and that's because they don't really want to cast a ballot for Carrie Lake. So I think that yesterday's events provide a lot of clarity, but they don't necessarily – the picture was fuzzy before. It's clear now, but it's still the same picture.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I have obviously have an interest in this race just because of my background, because of my, you know, my interest in politics and politics in my state, which I think are fascinating, from, you know, Carl Hayden to Barry Goldwater to John McCain to cinema, you know, to Mo Udall. I mean, these are really interesting people. I mean, we had a governor in the 90s who had a beehive hairdo, you know, Rose Mofford. So, I mean, like, I just think it's a fascinating place. And again, this race, whether it was the three of them or the two of them, is still going to be very interesting. Just their backgrounds are kind of amazing. I mean, Carrie Lake is this, you know, TV personality from, you know, she was on the news, you know, she's on Fox News for years and was in, you know, everybody's living room, you know, every night for several years. She supported Obama and then had this, you know, magical transformation into a big MAGA hit, you know, person. You know, she's got a little celebrity touch. She's got that kind of weird charisma, you know, that some of the people in Trump's orbit have, that he also, you know, sort of gloms onto. And you know, she's got her grievances, which other people, she shares with other people. And then Gallego, you know, is, you know, the other kind of like dream candidate for a lot of people. He's a military veteran. You know, he's connected politically. I mean, he shows up at events. He shows up at, like, you know, like legislative district captain picnics. You know, I mean, he's that kind of guy. He goes out to, you know, like all the different reservations. I mean, he's a war hero. You know, so like it's just like it's this going to be this banger race, I think.
Yeah. No. This is immediately kind of a top tier contest. Both parties were holding their fire, I think is the best way to think about it, for slightly different reasons, right? Republicans have a rocky relationship with Carrie Lake. They've come around to her. I think we have seen a pretty clear consolidation among national Republicans here in D.C. Around her candidacy, but that took a while. And then, of course, Democrats, of course, were playing ultimately a game of chicken with Sinema, where they couldn't risk alienating her while she still sat in the Senate and could potentially seek reelection, but were also very clear-eyed about the fact that there was not really a path to victory for her there. And so, look, I think ultimately the biggest upshot here might be that this frees up the national Democratic apparatus to be far more aggressive in this race, not have to worry about alienating or angering Sinema when she still has the power to effectively make or break legislation in the Senate, you know, because they ran an ad against her or something like that.
Yeah. Real quickly, let's talk about Texas, and then I want to talk about some other races that, again, also were not on the ballot. But in Texas, Ted Cruz won his primary in the Republican primary for reelection. Colin Allred, a House Democrat, you know, he won a pretty crowded Democratic primary. And we, you know, Texas has a runoff law. You have to clear, you know, 50% in order to avoid a runoff. And he did that. I was surprised how quickly they called it in Texas, you know, because I thought that we might see, you know, just a slower count just to make sure that they got everybody. But he seemed to have a really solid amount of support, and they called the race, you know, before midnight and on Eastern time, and we were kind of done. And so now we've got a matchup, you know, between Colin Allred and Ted Cruz. Again, fascinating. The 2018 Beto O'Rourke Ted Cruz race was real interesting to cover and to observe. Allred is not Beto, but he brings his own kind of star power to this, and this is worth watching. It still probably favors Cruz, you know, particularly in a presidential year, but it's probably still worth, you know, keeping an eye on for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think that Texas is worth watching because it ultimately is one of Democrats' only opportunities at flipping a Republican-held seat. I mean, this is a brutal cycle for them when it comes to playing defense. They are on their heels in a half dozen or more states, and they only have really a margin of error of zero. You know, exactly. After Joe Manchin retired, I mean, that that resets the playing field at a 50-50 Senate from where we're at right now, if you count Sinema or that Arizona seat as being held by a Democrat. So if they lose one more seat on net, that's the whole ball game. And and so any opportunity they have to try and steal a seat from the Republicans, they have to take deadly seriously. And Texas is that seat. I agree with you that Allred is not Beto. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Right.
Because the things that made Beto really great also, I think, contributed to his downfall in terms of the star power and people, you know, liked that until they didn't. Allred, I think, is a more understated character, but he's doing what he needs to do so far to put this race on the map. And if you go and look, you know, we talk a lot about Beto's fundraising ability at the time. It seems so quaint now. Back in 2018, Beto raised $80 million. And that was like, oh my God, how could any Senate candidate raise so much money? And of course, in the two cycles that we've seen since then, you know, I don't even know if that's in the top 10 anymore, after the numbers we saw in 2020 and 2022. But back then, it was a huge amount of money. And if you actually chart kind of where they were at analogous periods in the election cycle, Allred is raising a lot more money than Beto was. So we'll see if he can scale up. I think winning without a runoff was like huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure I would go as far as to say as if he were forced into a runoff, that would have taken this race off the map. But I think it's a whole world of difference that he can focus on Cruz now and not have to worry about shoring up his Democratic support, especially because the guy who would have forced him into a runoff, Roland Gutierrez, may have exposed some of the weaknesses in the Democratic coalition among Hispanic and Latino voters. I mean, if you look at the map, Gutierrez cleans up in the Rio Grande Valley. He clearly was making that a central part of his pitch to voters that Texas Democrats needed to run a Latino against Cruz. And so Allred can work at mending that now instead of trying to overcome it. And so I think that's important. I think the other thing I'll say about this race is I think it's a good illustration of, like, sometimes we like to think about, like, party organizations as these all-powerful, calculating, you know, operations.
Smoke-filled rooms.
Exactly. And I think this is a great example. Texas, this race is a good example of why that's not necessarily the case, because in a world where I think we had the most efficient allocation of kind of Democratic political power, Roland Gutierrez would not be running for Senate. He would actually be running for a House seat for Texas's 23rd district, which is a marginal seat represented by a Republican, Tony Gonzalez, who is now facing a runoff against a significantly more conservative challenger, a guy named Brandon Herrera, who is a gun YouTuber, I think is the best way to describe him. He does YouTube videos about guns, and he's primarying Gonzalez because Gonzalez voted for a gun safety bill after the shooting in Uvalde. Gutierrez
is in his district too.
Which is in his district. And it's also in Gutierrez's district. And the bill was negotiated by Texas Senator John Cornyn. My point being, there's a real possibility that the Republicans put up a gun YouTuber in this district when all is said and done. And the Democrats don't really have a candidate there. There is a candidate, but he's not particularly formidable. If Gutierrez were running in that House seat instead of getting 16% in a Senate primary, that could be a top tier race. But but he's not, and so it isn't.
Missed opportunities. They can come back to haunt.
Yeah.
Let's shift to races that where we got a little clarity in the recent past, and we will end with a look into the future. if that works. So recently in Montana, another one of the toss-ups, the inside election is rated as a toss-up. Senator John Tester, a Democrat, is running for re-election. This is a red state for sure. Donald Trump is likely to win it running away. And Tester has managed to figure out a way to win. In 2006, he had the wind at his back because people were pissed at Bush and cranky about the Iraq War and so forth. But you know, he found a way to win in 2012 when Obama was losing the state. Found a way to win in 2018. So he's a survivor, and they thought that they might catch a break and he would get to run against Matt Rosendale, who's in the Freedom Caucus and, you know, is sort of easily, you know, kind of magnified, if you will, and to set up a contrast. Rosendale got into the race and looked like it was going to be a race between him and Tim Sheehy, a former Navy SEAL, a little bit more polished, if you will, if that's a, you know, kind of a objective term than Rosendale. And Rosendale was in the race for about a week. Steve Daines, who runs the National Republican Senatorial Committee, prevailed upon Donald Trump to endorse Sheehy to, you know, sort of maximize what he thought would be the best candidate. It'll be interesting how it plays out because Sheehy, like Rosendale, is not from Montana. Tester reminds people of this. Tester and his people remind people of just how long Tester's been in the state and just how long people like Rosendale and Sheehy and even the governor, Greg Gianforte, you know, have not been in Montana. It's something I'm somewhat familiar with. You know, like we would make fun of people who just moved to Arizona and, you know, started wearing like pearl handled revolvers to the grocery store, you know, like as rhinestone cowboys when I was a kid. But, you know, the thing is that the Republicans got the candidate, or at least the leadership here in Washington got the candidate they wanted. Some people, I think, are a little sore in the Rosendale support group. But like that seems like, again, this is going to go right down to the wire.
Yeah, I mean, you may have called them rhinestone cowboys back then. I think in Montana they call them Yellowstone now. I think it's a bit of a similar conversation in some regards. And whatever strengths Tim Sheehy brings to the table, his decorated military service, his vast personal wealth, he also comes with a lot of baggage. The case against
a billionaire gentleman rancher. I don't know if he's a billionaire or not. I shouldn't say that. But he's a rich gentleman rancher.
He's very rich. He's bought up a lot of land in Montana over the last 10 years. And I think there are opportunities aplenty for Democrats to litigate a lot of stuff in his background. Now, unlike Rosendale, he doesn't have a voting record. He doesn't have a Maryland accent, which I always thought was so funny. As a Marylander, I feel like, the notion that there is a Maryland accent, I don't really think that there is one. And B, when I do think there is one, it's a Baltimore accent, which Rosendale also does not have.
Right.
I think it just, you know, he didn't sound like he was from Montana, right? And of course, like you mentioned, Sheehy isn't from Montana either. He's, I believe he's from Wisconsin, moved to the state about a decade ago after he retired from the Navy SEALs. But no, I think that Sheehy fits into the larger profile of Republicans running for Senate this cycle, in that he is a really rich guy with potential to put a lot of personal money into the race. He does not come from a political background, but he also has, vulnerabilities about his ties to the state where he's running in. And that is a story that we see play out pretty much. I mean, pick your battleground state, and that
Wisconsin.
Is Wisconsin, you know? Eric Hovde, Pennsylvania, Dave McCormick. I mean, New Mexico, Nella Domenici. You know, it's like Kerry Lake and Sam Brown are kind of the only two. And Sam Brown would qualify were he I think, a little bit more middle class than some of these other guys, because he also moved to Nevada more recently from Texas. He is Sam Brown of the Browns, like the football team, but I'm not sure how much of that money has trickled down to his generation. But anyways, to your point about Montana, look, I think this is going to be one of the two races that determines Senate control.
Right.
Montana and Ohio are the ball game. Democrats have to win both. If they can win both, they hold the Senate. If they lose either one, they are not going to hold the Senate. And they are fortunate that they've got a guy in John Tester who is an excellent politician who has incredibly deep roots in the state, and who has distinguished himself from the National Democratic brand to a degree that I don't really think any Democrat not named Joe Manchin can lay claim to. And all of that has allowed him to win by the skin of his teeth in three consecutive elections. This one will be no different. I think if he wins, it will be by the narrowest of margins. And, you know, if he loses, it will be because, like his former colleagues, Heidi Heitkamp and Claire McCaskill, it's just become too difficult to hold on in a state that's going to vote Republican at the top of the ticket by 15 points or more.
Right. Yeah. All right. Let's turn our attention to the future and the last of the toss-up races that Inside Elections has rated as a toss-up, and what you just referenced, which is Ohio. Sherrod Brown is running for re-election. This is, you know, the Sherrod Brown's name goes back, you know, way, way back as a, you know, not just him, but his family in terms of the, you know, Ohio Democratic politics. You know, he's got this persona, you know, that I think it works well to go along with the familiarity. You know, he's got like rumpled clothes and hair and, you know, kind of this growly voice, and it doesn't seem affected either. It seems like that's really what he sounds like in, you know, in unguarded moments as well. You know, he's got a lot of name recognition. He's got a lot of goodwill that's built up over the years. Ohio has trended increasingly Republican since he, you know, has come into the Senate in 2006. And it's a crowded Republican primary to take him on. That primary is March 19th. We've got Matt Dolan, who's, you know, run a couple for office and is a statewide office holder. We got Frank LaRose and we got Bernie Moreno. And, you know, this is interesting because the establishment here, Steve Daines and so forth, were not able to clear the field for any one of them. You know, Dolan's got more money than God, I think, you know, and background in professional sports, you know, management and so forth. Moreno is the, you know, kind of the choice of the Trump family. He was just campaigning with Donald Trump Jr. in Ohio. And Frank LaRose is also a, you know, sort of a not the kind of name brand that Sherrod Brown is, but certainly he's, you know, held political office and has a constituency. And it's unclear, you know, who may have the edge here because there's a lot of competing interests going at each other. I mean, for as red as Ohio is getting, as we saw with like J.D. Vance's, you know, sort of MAGA pivot in 2022, there's also people like the governor, Mike DeWine, who is not a MAGA guy. So what's your take on this? Because, again, as you said, this will be, you know, if Democrats lose this race, they lose a majority, period.
Yeah. Definitely the most competitive Republican primary on the map this cycle. You know, arguably Michigan could develop into something a little more competitive, but Ohio certainly of all of these races is the one place where nobody was really able to clear the field. I think Bernie Moreno probably has the inside track at this point, given the Trump endorsement. And I mean, we all remember kind of what the Trump endorsement did for J.D. Vance in the 2022 primary. It really helped elevate him above a race that had seen a whole number of front runners over the course of its duration. Josh Mandel, Mike Gibbons, a lot of figures there before Vance was able to assert himself. You know, he and Dolan have poured a lot of personal money into this race, and that has made it difficult for LaRose to really capitalize on, like you said, the fact that he is more of a known quantity. He's held statewide office. He has had several statewide offices. He's been around. And in the past, he's actually had a bit more of a moderate reputation when he was the chief elections officer for the state in the 2020 election. He pushed back against the notion that Trump had the election had been stolen from Trump. You know, he has had to adjust his politics to try and win this Senate primary, but he has really struggled financially to keep pace with Marino and Dolan. Of course, Dolan's family owns the Cleveland Guardians baseball team. I think the problem for Dolan is that his support is probably capped. You know, we saw in the 2022 primary when Dolan ran, he placed, I believe, second to Vance with about 25% of the vote after a late surge. But I think there's an expectation that it's not clear if he can get more than that, just given that he has, while he hasn't outright kind of attacked Trump, he has put more distance between himself and Trump than the other candidates have, and that rubs a lot of Republican voters the wrong way. And then something as you know, esoteric or unrelated as the Guardians' name change, right? Going from the Cleveland Indians to the Cleveland Guardians. Of course, that wasn't his decision himself. There are a lot of members of that family that have a say in the operation of the team, but that is also something that was not particularly popular with Republican voters. And that's, I think, a real concern for him. And it's a real item that gets brought up. So, look, I think that any of the three could win on primary night, and I wouldn't be shocked. I think Marino has the inside track. And then it's a question of, you know, can Sherrod Brown outperform the top of the ticket enough to win a state that has become much more reliably Republican? I mean, you know, voted for Trump by around 8 points in both 2016 and 2020, not for lack of trying from Democrats. I mean, both Clinton and Biden made efforts in Ohio, and it didn't click. So we'll see. This will be Brown's toughest race, I would argue, certainly since 2006, when he beat a guy named Mike DeWine. Wonder what happened to him. But like you said, I mean, we're talking a lot about these 06 babies, but you know, that was that Democratic wave year. And then in 12, I mean, Obama won Ohio, right? It wasn't like Brown was rowing against the tide there. And then in 2018, of course, Democratic wave year writ large, but also Brown was running against a pretty flawed candidate in Jim Renacci, who he was able to outspend quite significantly. So I think this is going to be a really tight race. I think Brown, of course, brings a lot to the table. He's a strong fundraiser. Marino's a bit more of an unknown quantity. But it's interesting. A lot of the people that I talked to are actually a little bit more bullish on Tester, despite Montana being a bit more Republican than they are on Brown. And I think that just has to do with the size of the state and how difficult or easy it is to cultivate that kind of brand when your state is a million people like Montana, right? Or, you know, I don't know Ohio's population off the top of my head, but it's got to be close to 10x Montana.
I don't have it off the top of my head either, but I mean, yeah, when you have two, you know, congressional reps, you know, versus 15.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, you have major population centers with huge histories like Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, yeah. Dayton, you know, Toledo. I mean, like Ohio is several states in itself. So, you know, what works in a, you know, Cleveland market may not work in Columbus, you know,
yeah.
and vice versa. So, well, Jacob, we went through a lot. We could have discussed more, you know, more races, but I think that by focusing on the closest ones, you know, this is the best message for our listeners. Hopefully they're still listening out there. but I love talking about this stuff with you. I mean, sorry if I went a little overboard on Arizona. You know, it's something I tend to do sometimes. But I think it's going to be a good race. And, you know, we look forward to having you back the next time.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks very much for listening out there. Check us out on YouTube. Like us. Do all that stuff that makes things better in social media. Thanks. Bye.